where Fairfield comes for news and talk. The Lisa Wexler Show, now on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch, a spider's touch.
And welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. Shirley Bassey. The little bit of music that you're hearing throughout our show today is because we are highlighting some of the career highlights of Leslie Bricus, who passed away, composer and lyricist. So that's the music that you're hearing today. And I'm very taken with it. 203-333-9422. And by the way, I'm going to be seeing my first Broadway show post-COVID tomorrow night. I'm going to see Freestyle Love Supreme, which is actually the revival of an older show, but it was the first show written by Lin-Manuel Miranda, and I'm told it's a little bit improvisational. It's a late curtain at 9 o'clock with no intermission of about 90 minutes, and I have to get there early, Bill and I, because we have to make sure that we have our vaccination proof and everything else, but I will be happy to share the experience of going to a Broadway show on Monday. And I'm excited to be able to do that. But Leslie Bricus was a great writer, and he was principally known on Broadway for Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, which was a smash hit in the 60s about, and it was written with Anthony Newley, about somebody's struggle for identity. And, of course, he went on to write Dr. Dolittle, one of my favorite movie musicals of all time, as well as Willy Wonka, and then a bunch of other hits. He wrote for some 007 movies. 203-333-9422. What a gift that is. Our own favorite composer here in the area, David Friedman, is going to be joining us for a weekly segment as soon as he feels well enough to do so. He's still recuperating from a surgery, but he's okay. He's okay, and he's going to be even more okay. And when he feels up to it, he'll be joining us on a weekly basis as well. 203-333-9422. I wanted to get to the other top story of the day. We are waiting, by the way, for Mitch Albom to call in, and hopefully he will do so soon. And then when we do, I'll interrupt myself to bring him on. But I did want to mention another very top story of the day, which is that State Representative Michael DeMassa of West Haven facing federal charges for allegedly, and let me stress allegedly, misappropriating more than $636,000 in federal relief funding, in other words, COVID money, which was provided to the city of West Haven last year in order to help West Haven, which is not a rich place, pay for expenses tied to the coronavirus pandemic. He is a Democrat, Michael DeMassa. He represents West Haven in the state legislature. He's already been stripped by the Democratic leaders of all of his committee assignments. He was arrested yesterday morning. He appeared in federal court in New Haven on a single count of wire fraud and was released after posting $250,000 bail, which meant he probably had to come up with somewhere around $25,000. He didn't leave a comment as he left the courthouse. Federal prosecutors are alleging, and again, it's an allegation. It's a complaint. Do we know that it's true? We don't. But the allegation is that while he was serving as administrative assistant to the West Haven City Council and a state rep for the people of West Haven, somehow he was able to illegally funnel hundreds of thousands of dollars to his own LLC that he established in 2021 under the name of Compass Investment Group, and then under that LLC provided invoices to the West Haven city government for coronavirus-related jobs, which would then be paid to him under the auspices and trusting that he would then hire people and funnel that money to individuals. But according to the federal investigators, the city did not get those services and nothing happened in return for those payments. And then, and this is really the most important part of the story, the FBI and U.S. attorneys allege, not proven, allege that DeMassa then personally withdrew tens of thousands of dollars from the LLC and used at least some of that cash to buy gambling chips at the Mohegan Sun Casino. When I see a statement like that, I say to myself, perhaps we're dealing with a gambling problem. Do you remember that former congressman from our area, Chris Shays? Do you remember that he had a very trusted assistant who apparently embezzled about $300,000 from campaign funds in order to fund his own gambling habit. Gambling is a terrible addiction. It is its own cycle of destruction. And I have pointedly not spoken that much at all about the fact that we are now legalizing and have legalized a lot of different ways for people to gamble in Connecticut that we didn't used to. We have sports gambling. As far as I'm concerned, the legislature made a deal in order to enrich the tax coffers of the state of Connecticut, in my view, without really looking into what will likely be some of the very negative effects on individuals and individual households as a result of how easy it will be to get addicted to gambling. It's my opinion. But in any event, with State Representative Michael DeMassa facing this charge and this one line about gambling, it's my aha moment of the story where I say, well, what would possess somebody with a name and a reputation and such and a career and so much to lose? He's a state rep, for goodness sakes. He could probably give you a laundry list of the favors, and I mean the good favors that he's done for people in his district, and the kinds of policies that he's been supporting of that he thought has helped his community become a better place to live. Why would he misappropriate, steal, whatever the allegation is, over $600,000 of COVID money to a shell of an LLC? If he was a gambling addict, that's why. That's why. Because he thought he could score the next big win. I'm Lisa Wexler, and it's a shame and a tragedy. 203-333-9422, but it is merely an allegation. Okay, an allegation followed by an arrest. We are going to turn now to one of my favorite authors. One of my favorite authors is Mitch Albom, and he writes these amazingly readable, fabulous little, and they are physically quite little, page turners in these small, very notable and noticed books. The latest is called The Stranger in the Lifeboat. Mr. Albom will be coming to the Westport Library where you can meet him in person, shake his hand and sign a book and have him sign a book for you and maybe even have a picture with him. I think he's coming November 2nd. Is that right? November 2nd to the Westport Library in my hometown. Mitch Albom, welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. Hello and good morning.
Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Good. I don't know if you remember, but we met personally at the Ridgefield Playhouse when you were coming through. And I don't know if you remember that appearance, but I really enjoyed meeting you, and I'm very glad you're coming to Westport. You're coming soon.
Yes, November 2nd is actually the day that The Stranger in the Lifeboat is released, so it's I think it's the first event that I'm doing for the book, so I'm happy to be able to do it there, and I'm happy to be able to do anything these days. You know, to be able to go live and meet people is a thrill. I never thought I'd say that.
I know, it's true, but you're also coming on Election Day. You know that, right? It's big. And we have a big election
in
Westport.
That doesn't.
Yeah, no, but you'll have a lot of people on the streets. There'll be a lot of people going in between campaign headquarters. There'll be a lot of activity. I mean, for a small town, there'll be a lot of activity that evening. But you'll get a very big welcome, I'm sure. So, Mitch Albom, I am in the middle, so no spoiler. But in a way, it's a spoiler from the first page, but that's okay. I'm in the middle of your book called The Stranger in the Lifeboat. And my question is, a little bit Life of Pi here. My question is, what gave you the idea to write this book? Like, why this book at this time?
Okay. Well, in order to explain that, I have to give your listeners a quick synopsis of what the book is without giving it away, as you say. It's a bit of a thriller adventure story, but there's a lifeboat. There's a luxury yacht owned by one of the richest people in the world. He's got this big event with some of the most important high-flying people in the world are attending it. And suddenly there's this inexplicable explosion. The boat blows up and all but 10 people are perished. And these 10 people find their way to a lifeboat. And half of them are the rich guests, including the guy who owned the boat. And half of them are workers who serve the guests. And for 3 days, they're waiting for somebody to come find them or get them. Nobody comes. There's no sign of anything, no planes, no boats. They're desperate. They're running out of food. They're out of water. They're crying out for help. And suddenly they see this body floating in the ocean and they pull it in. It's this young guy, very nondescript, average, looks like a kind of surfer guy. And they start peppering him with questions, and he doesn't say anything. Where'd you come from? Doesn't say anything. And finally, one of the women on the boat says, "Well, thank the Lord we found you." And he says, "I am the Lord." And it sort of takes off from that premise there, you know, that this strange guy floats into their boat, and they end up saying, you know, "Wait a minute, if you're the Lord, what are you doing here?" And he says, "Well, weren't you calling for me?" You know, and they say, "Well, so you're here to save us?" And he says, "Well, I can only save you if everybody in the boat believes I am who I say I am at the same time." And the book follows the days as they pass, because not all the people on the boat believe in him. And he certainly doesn't look like God or act like God. He falls asleep a lot. He gets hungry. he says some cryptic things. And, you know, you have to it follows what happens as the days and turn into weeks out at sea, and strange things keep happening. And I won't give away a whole lot more than that. As to why I wrote it, well, sort of. It's a bit of a parable for what do we do in life if we ask for help, or we ask for divine help, and it comes, but we don't recognize it. Like, it's not exactly what we asked for. How many times in your life have you looked back on it and said, you know, at the time, I was really angry with that, or I thought that was really bad, but it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, people say that sentence all the time. Well, maybe it was always intended to be the best thing that ever happened. You just didn't recognize it when it came in its form. And so that was I've had that happen so many times in my life that I wanted to do a book where that was sort of the underlying lesson.
We're chatting with Mitch Albom, and he's coming to Westport on November 2nd to the library to talk about his latest, The Stranger in the Lifeboat. You know, I actually have a term for that, Mitch, in my own life. I call it the unseen hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I refer to it all the time, that the unseen hand is some kind of force, some kind of something spiritual that is happening in our lives that sort of has a hand in our destiny in a way that we can't see at the time that it's happening. But it's happening nonetheless.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that could be a subtitle for this book. You know, because the unseen hand is sort of the stranger in everybody's, you know, we're all kind of in a lifeboat when you think about it. We're all floating around trying to stay alive and doing what we can. And we all have this stranger in the boat with us. And it kind of depends on how much you want to believe that that is an unseen hand, or some people it's God, some people it's the universe talking to them. The less you make it a stranger, the more you sort of embrace it, the more you kind of understand your own life and why things happen the way that they do. You know, I wrote a book called Tuesdays with Maury that a lot of people know about. But at the time when that happened, I was a very ambitious, hard-driving sports writer and sportscaster. And suddenly there was this old man who was dying from Lou Gehrig's disease, an old professor of mine. And I kind of went out to see him under an obligation. And then I came back to see him under an obligation. At the time, I was like, you know, I'm busy. I have to take a day out of my life to go there. You know, well, as it turned out, that was the most fundamental thing probably that's ever happened in my life. And, you know, I ended up writing a book to pay his medical bills. It was supposed to be a little book. It became a very big book, and it sort of changed the trajectory of my life. But at the time, I wouldn't have said, oh, the universe is sending me this because I'm heading down a bad path of just being nothing but a, you know, ambition and accomplishment. And yet now I look back on it, and it actually, you know, was a turning point. So there are many things that have happened like that in my life, and I imagine readers of the book will find many that happened to them.
We're chatting with Mitch Albom. The book is called The Stranger in the Lifeboat. You know, Mitch, I was struck by one of your sentences in the book. And I'm going to paraphrase it because I should have clipped it, but I didn't. But it's a sentence that you have the individual who's playing the God character say about somebody else, and just ask directly, well, you know, was that person a good person? Did he help the poor? Did he love other people? And you have like this checklist of things that boil down to the essentials of a life worth living and a life that's remembered for good deeds. And I was struck by that sentence in the book because you know, I thought, wow, yeah, that really sums up what it's supposed to be. But it's so easy to take a measure of the other things, Mitch. It's so easy to take a measure of how much is in our bank account. And, you know, and do we have, you know what I mean? It's so easy to take a measure of the material things in life.
Well, because that's how society measures it for us, you know, and we're told by society, this is what matters. You know, what's your job? How much do you earn? What kind of house do you live in? What kind of car do you drive? And a lot of us buy into that. But I know the moment you're talking about in the book, and I'm glad you focused on that, because it's one of the passengers dies, and he was a very successful programmer, TV programmer, you know, rich and accomplished, and he, you know, like the guy who ran Netflix. And they're trying to figure out what to say about him now
that
he's dead. And yeah, and so one of the other Ritz guys goes, well, he was a hell of a programmer. You know, and they're all looking around, and finally the God character says, well, but, you know, did he, and you, as you point out, you know, was he kind to others? Did he share of his soul? Did he give of himself? Did he love me? You know, and the other Ritz guy says, show some respect. He's dead. You know, that's
right, which was
typical,
funny.
But
typical.
Yeah. Which is what a person who measures his life by money would say. Yeah. So, yeah, I kind of thought, Lisa, that, you know, like if you had God come on your radio program for 5 minutes, you know, he's okay, Lisa, I'm going to grant you 5 minutes, ask me whatever you want. And what would the questions be? And I tried to sort of use those questions in this book at some point or another. I bet if I pose that question to you right now, so what would you, if God came on your program for 5 minutes, what would be like the one question you'd want to get answered?
What is my purpose in life?
Huh. Well, that kind of is asked by these characters multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
And so is the one about, like, why do people die? You know, why do you make people die? Why do you take people away from us? And as someone who's lost a lot of people in his life, you know, I've asked that question a million times. And when one of the characters poses that to him and says, you know, he lost his wife, said, why did you take my wife? And he's crying. And the God character, the man who calls himself God, says, well, look, I love you. You know, I don't do things to hurt you. And I know that you cry when loved ones lose their lives on this earth. But I promise you, the ones who lost their lives are not crying. And, you know, if you believe in heaven, or if you believe that there's something after this life, then that would be true. And you would think, well, right, we're crying, but they're not crying. And that's what, if there is a God or a universe, that's what it would do. And so I had a chance to sort of, you know, play that character during the course of this book and, you know, answer some of those fundamental questions, like, you know, what's my purpose? What happens when we die? Are our prayers answered? At one point, one of the women says to him, well, do you answer all the prayers that you hear? And he says, I answer all the prayers, but sometimes the answer is no. You know,
true. That is true.
Yeah.
We're chatting with Mitch Albom. We're talking about his latest book, The Stranger in the Lifeboat. He's coming to the Westport Library November 2nd. You know, I, Mitch, in my other life, in other words, which is to say that I have two very distinct careers, this one, which I adore, being on the radio with you, and then I'm also the probate judge in Westport, and that requires me to decide on all of these mental capacity hearings all the time, and because we have a mental health hospital in my district, I am presiding over hearings affecting people with schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder 1, which sometimes has psychotic delusions. And one of the first things that struck me and strikes me a lot about faith and about stories like yours are the people that I come in contact with every day that have very fixed and real delusions about their own godliness. And they really do believe that they are Jesus Christ incarnate or Pharaoh or God. And, you know, I once spoke to a very talented psychiatrist in our area, and we spoke about, you know, there are many aspects of the brain and the spirit that we don't know and we can't access. And that to sometimes when you talk to people who are schizophrenic, sometimes you feel like maybe they are accessing something that the rest of us can't see right now. Maybe.
Fascinating. Yeah.
You know,
sounds
because
like another, that sounds like a book that you should write. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. But I wanted to ask you, Mitch, we're chatting with Mitch Albom, how fixed and significant is faith in your life? Because so much of your books deal with the afterlife.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, I would not say I'm heavily religious. I was raised with faith. And I think for a while I kind of drifted away from it, and then I sort of came back to it after Maury and after many things I've seen. There's a subplot in the book where the inspector, who the police inspector, who finds the notebook that is telling this story, because the raft washes up on shore a year later with nobody in it and just a notebook inside, that he's reading the story of this account, and he and his wife lost a little girl, and she drowned. And in the book, you know, the wife turns to religion for comfort and he turns the opposite way. And that happened to myself and my wife. I operate an orphanage in Haiti ever since the 2010 earthquake. And I'm there every month, and we have 53 children that we raised there. And one of those children a few years back developed a brain tumor, and we brought her to America thinking that, you know, they would operate her and they'd bring her right back. And they told us that it was fatal and in stage four, and that she would be dead in 4 months, and, you know, just bring her home to Haiti. And we said, no, she's a fighter, and we'll fight this thing as long as it takes. And she lived 2 years, and we adopted her, and she became our daughter. And we traveled around the world trying to find a cure for her. And then during that time became a very kind of unlikely family. And she was, you know, the most wonderful blessing that my wife and I have ever had. Or when she finally died, we went opposite directions. My wife, you know, kind of buried herself in the church and faith and believed, you know, that this was meant to be and God was taking care of her. And I was very much like the character in the book, the inspector, who says, you know, what kind of benevolent God can't be benevolent to a 5-year-old child, you know, and why does God need a little child in heaven so badly to rip her away from us? And, you know, I got very angry with the idea of God or universe and said, you know, this must be junk. But eventually, you know, sort of made peace with that too. So I'm a person who, I would say I'm a faithful person. I do believe that there's something beyond this world, but I have my struggles. And that was kind of part of Stranger in the Lifeboat, was sort of to ask these questions of this character. And this God character in the book doesn't behave. That's the thing. He doesn't look like God. He doesn't have flowing robes or white hair or a beard or anything like that. He's like a schlub, you know. He sleeps a lot. He gets hungry. He's asking for food all the time. He sometimes he says yes and sometimes he says no and sometimes he just goes to sleep. And you know, that to me is sort of what you have to kind of go through if you believe in something bigger than yourself, that it's not always going to answer your prayers at that moment. You know, it's not always going to behave the way that you expect it to, and neither does this character in the Lifeboat.
Yeah. Mitch Albom, I feel like I've only skimmed the surface of talking to you, but you know, we're on live radio, so I've run out of time. But I'm going to make it my point to come see you again November 2nd as I make the rounds of all
Wonderful.
The different campaign headquarters, but I'm definitely coming over to the library to see you. I want to shake your hand, take another picture, and wish you well. And thank you for coming to town. And thank you for writing just another wonderful, lovely book. I'm loving it. It's called The Stranger in the Lifeboat. I'm halfway through. I'm going to sit down and finish it tonight. It's great. And I also love the way you print. You print in a way that I can hold it in my hand easily and carry it with me. And you do, Mitch. You tell a great story. You tell a great story. So thank you.
That's very kind. I look forward to seeing you, Lisa, and everybody else on November 2nd.
You bet. Mitch Albom on The Lisa Wexler Show. Don't forget, the book is The Stranger in the Lifeboat, and he's coming to town November 2nd. We'll be right back.